You are about to hear the keynote address at a January 7, 2018 event at Johnson County Community College in Overland Park, Kansas, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. The address was entitled, Dr. King at the Mountaintop, A Drum Major for Peace. It summarized King's life and times. The presenter was Ryan Jones, historian at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Well, let's just go briefly into a synopsis of why we are all here today. Many of you may not know is that his birth name was Michael King, born on January 15, 1929 in Atlanta, Georgia. And his father, Michael King Sr., traveled to Germany in 1934. And there he was very moved and influenced by a German reformer and philosopher, Martin Luther, to the point where he changed his name and his son's name to Martin Luther King Sr. and Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. was an exceptional student, graduated from high school at the age of 15, attended Morehouse College, and also went to seminary school in Boston University. He marries his wife of Marion, Alabama, Ms. Coretta Scott, in June of 1953, who will become the architect of preserving the legacy of her slain husband. But things began to change in the mid-1950s, post-World War II. And Dr. King's story starts in late November 1955. 2 months before that, a tragedy occurred in the Mississippi Delta. A 14-year-old youth named Emmett Till was brutally lynched in Delta, Mississippi. And so people were having protests and demonstrations because of the scanty trial that occurred several days later. And it was the Sunday after Thanksgiving, 1955, a man by the name of Dr. T.R.M. Howard from Mississippi is speaking in Montgomery, Alabama. And in that audience that night, there are two individuals who are listening to this message, listening to how this child was tortured and eventually lynched, and viewed his battered corpse in magazines across the nation that we can no longer wait any longer. And those two individuals were 42-year-old seamstress named Rosa Parks, and this event is occurring at a church named Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And the newly ordained minister of this church was none other than Martin Luther King Jr. So that following Thursday, on December the 1st, Rosa Parks, as we know, defied the segregation code of Montgomery, Alabama. And they decided that they had to boycott this city. We're going to do so nonviolently, but we had to elect a leader. Now, Dr. King is 26 years old at this time. He's been married for 3 years, and his first child, Yolanda, is only 4 months old at this point. But Dr. King is approached by the Montgomery Improvement Association, and he says, we would like for you to lead this boycott in the community of Montgomery. We want someone with youth, someone with charisma, someone that no one knows. And Dr. King said, hey, I just want to preach in my pulpit on Sunday. But Dr. King received that call that night, after talking over with his wife, Coretta. And the following day, Monday, December the 5th, Dr. King gives his first publicized speech in the civil rights era at the First Baptist Church. And of course, for the entire year of 1956, Montgomery is a walking city. African Americans are walking, carpooling, using black-owned taxis to get back and forth to their destinations. And later that year, in December, the Supreme Court ruled that segregation on those city buses was unconstitutional. So this is the first major accomplishment and achievement of Dr. King as a civil rights leader and of the civil rights movement as a whole. Dr. King travels to Africa and to India to study the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi about nonviolent resistance and nonviolent direct action. And the world is beginning to change as we go into the decade of the 1960s. Sit-ins are taking place across the South. Freedom riders, interracial group of civil rights activists are traveling from the North End to the South. Schools are being integrated, Little Rock, Ole Miss, University of Alabama. And Dr. King at this time, he's still a household name. He has Montgomery behind him. But 1963, we are in a very, very different situation. to talk about the context of where we are at that point. In 1963, Dr. King had just left Albany, Georgia. Albany, Georgia, and the civil rights movement is a precursor to why Jim Crow no longer exists. Albany, Dr. King uses nonviolent resistance tactics, but the sheriff in Albany was a man by the name of Lori Pritchett. And Lori Pritchett read Dr. King's book, Stride Toward Freedom. And he knew that the best way to cripple the civil rights movement was to not give it any kind of media exposure. So the protesters were arrested, but they were arrested, as you would say, much nicer than other Southern sheriffs in Southern towns would do so. With no violence in Albany, no one paid attention to it. So he was at a standstill. So around Christmas 1962, Dr. King receives a phone call from one of his associates in Birmingham, Alabama. And this man's name is Fred Shuttlesworth. And he says, if you come to Birmingham, you'll get the response that you need. For me growing up, it's almost as if Dr. King's influence on my life is spiritual. As a six-year-old, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. And this is where I was first taught of who Martin Luther King was. I set the I Have a Dream speech as my first book report in elementary school. But in Birmingham in 1963, this was the most segregated city in America. The black sections of Birmingham were known as Dynamite Hill and Pearl Harbor. It was known as Bombingham. They also had the Birmingham Police Commissioner of Public Safety, a man named Eugene Bull Connor. You'll hear about him in a minute. And they also just inaugurated a new governor on January the 14th, Governor George C. Wallace, who said in his inaugural statement, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. This was the atmosphere that Dr. King and the rest of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were entering in that year. For the first few months, it's moderate. Not much is going on. But on Good Friday, 1963, Dr. King is arrested, and he's put in a Birmingham jail. And clergymen, men of God, some black, some white, go to the jail and they ask Dr. King to postpone his protests in Birmingham. And Dr. King is a little bewildered by this. Men of the ministry are saying, you should not fight for your internal demands. So while in jail, Dr. King responds to this criticism. He says, an unjust law is no law at all. Justice delayed is justice denied. We are exactly 100 years since President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. So 100 years later, there are individuals in this society that can't go into a restaurant and be served. They can't go to the school of their choice without being attacked. If you don't get off the sidewalk, you could be humiliated and or killed. So we cannot have a cooling off period. Once he's released several days later, he feels that he needs to capture the eyes of the world. And adults were participating in the civil rights movement. But they knew that children should make an impact on us, the youth. So Dr. King encourages in the schools in the city of Birmingham to have their children march for their parents. So on the evenings of May the 2nd and May the 3rd, 1963, you see these infamous images of children, 7 years old to 17 years old, being attacked by high-power water hoses, German shepherds, shown all over the entire planet Earth. In the White House, the 35th President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was extremely moved by this, to the point that he was going to do something that his 19 predecessors before him were unable to do. So on Tuesday, June 11th, 1963, JFK goes on national television and he tells the country that segregation has no place in American society. Those who do nothing are invited shame. Later that night, Medgar Evers is assassinated in Jackson, Mississippi. Because of what occurred in Birmingham, propelled what we now know as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Sure, President Kennedy was not able to sign this into law because of the tragedy that occurred in Dallas, but his successor, Lyndon Johnson, makes this happen while Dr. King stood to his left and actually gave Dr. King the pen that he signed the act into. So Jim Crow was over. Voting rights occurs. Selma, Alabama. African Americans can sometimes go into whatever public facility, public accommodation that they desire, but they still can't vote. And the right to vote given in the 15th and 19th Amendments in our Constitution are internal demands that you were born with. You shouldn't have to guess how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. They shouldn't have to guess how many seeds were in a watermelon. Dr. King lends his support in Selma. People are killed, people are injured, people are afraid. But his persistence leads to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, a lot of people feel that the civil rights movement ended there. And Dr. King, as a figure, a national figure, which is really brought after the March on Washington on August 28, 1963, the perception that a lot of Americans had of him begins to change dramatically. This is Dr. King that I'll briefly talk about now. In 1966, the world is at a crossroads when it comes to civil and human rights. You have those who participate in nonviolent resistance, but then you have some that say, hey, we'll be nonviolent with people who are nonviolent with us, but we will not be nonviolent with anyone who uses violence upon us. Why would I want to go sit at a lunch counter with someone who feels that I'm inferior to him? These people countered what Dr. King's message was, and they felt that nonviolence was not very timely. Dr. King's fate was sealed April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day that he'd be tragically assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. He was speaking at the Riverside Baptist Church in New York City, and he gave a speech called Beyond Vietnam. I'm going to read a quote from what Dr. King said at that speech. He said, "A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out of no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say that this is not just." He concludes that speech and says, "A country that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." Now immediately, Dr. King is labeled unpatriotic. He's labeled a traitor. They're calling him a communist. Even the African American community has turned their backs on him. He goes through a very long depression during the latter year part of 1967 because of this speech. He travels to the Mississippi Delta, which is the poorest region in the United States of America, still to this day. And he goes inside of a classroom and he sees children that are 8, 9, 10 years old being fed apple slices for lunch because of the extreme oppressive poverty and economic disparities in our country. So he plans something known as the Poor People's Campaign. Dr. King was going to travel by mule train from all of the poverty-stricken areas of the United States, black and whites, to the nation's capital to demand that some sort of economic justice is done in our society. While in the middle of this, there's something that's going on in my native town, Memphis, Tennessee. Sanitation workers, African-American men, who sometimes have families of 5 to 10 in their household, are earning about $1.50 an hour.
You are listening to Ryan Jones summarizing the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr.
One day, on a Tuesday, February the 1st, 1968, two of these men are on a garbage route, and it's raining, it's thunderstorms, and because of the black, they're not able to go inside of the truck itself. So to shelter themselves outside of this thunderstorm, they go into the back of the truck. And this truck was very faulty. It had been reported to the City of Memphis Department that this truck should not be in use. Nevertheless, it still was. A malfunction occurs, and The two men are crushed to death in the back of this truck. Dr. King hears about this in Atlanta, and he's visibly shaken about it. A few weeks later, Dr. King is invited to come to Memphis because of the spark of these two men being killed in this garbage truck, where men in the city of Memphis are carrying a picket sign in downtown Memphis saying, "I am a man." Simply, "I am a man." But they were not treated as men under what the Declaration of Independence says, under what the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States says, and under the newly passed civil rights legislative laws. So Dr. King felt that he had to take a detour to the city of Memphis. He arrives there on March the 18th for the very first time, and he's still very depressed. But when he arrives at the Mason Temple Church of God in Christ, 1,000 people are there, and he receives a wonderful reception. So he goes back down, and he sits next to Ralph Abernathy, and he says, "Maybe we should come back and meet a march here in Memphis on behalf of these sanitation workers." Half of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were for it, the other half were adamantly against it. Ultimately, Dr. King made the decision. We're going to go back to Memphis. 10 days later, he arrives back on March 28th. And once he arrives there, a few minutes after the march begins on Bill Street, there are looting and there is violence. Dr. King, being a disciplined and determined believer of nonviolent resistance, this is the first and only march that he leads that ends in chaos. Again, he's bewildered to the point for his own safety, they have to get him off of the streets. So they take him to the nearest hotel, which was the Holiday Inn Rivermont. This was a predominantly white hotel. Keep in mind that there is a vitriol obsession of discrediting Dr. King by the FBI during this time. So they know what's going on. Dr. King, on the next day on the 29th, goes back to Atlanta, man. He's weeping. He just doesn't talk to anyone. He's not eating. He's losing weight. No one knows what's going to happen. So he comes out of his study, and he tells Ralph, he tells Andrew Young and others, he says, "In Montgomery, and in Birmingham, and in Selma, nonviolence won. Memphis is not going to be this different situation. We will go back. We will lead a nonviolent campaign, even if it costs us our lives." So the time to come back is Wednesday, April the 3rd. And Dr. King read a press release by the Memphis Daily News, and it said that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this apostle of nonviolence for civil rights, is staying at the all-white hotel at Rivermont when he's not getting business to the all-black home, Lorraine Motel. Lorraine Motel was the Plaza Hotel of the 1960s in Memphis. People from Sam Cooke to Jackie Robinson, Cap Calloway, Aretha Franklin, so many others were normal guests here. Why is Dr. King not going to stay at the all-black hotel? He's visibly affected by this as well. So that morning, he boards Eastern Airlines Flight 381 out of Atlanta International and route to Memphis. But they can't take off. When Dr. King and his aides arrive on the plane, there's a bomb threat. And they announce on the plane in front of everyone, "We're sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but we have a delayed flight this morning. We have the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on our plane, so we have to all evacuate from this airplane." 30, 45 minutes later, there's no bomb on the plane. So they arrive in Memphis at 10:30 that morning, and he checks in at the Lorraine Motel. Memphis is about to have some awful weather, inclement weather. There's tornado warnings all in the greater Memphis area, to where there were even 4 fatalities on that night. Dr. King has 101 temperature. He's suffering from laryngitis. He's also suffering from mental and physical exhaustion. And there was a rally that night at the Mason Temple, the Church of God in Christ, same church that he spoke at a few weeks earlier. And he doesn't think that there's going to be a large turnout at this rally. He thinks that people are going to stay in because of the weather, and that they will participate in the march that following Monday. So he sends Ralph Abernathy, UN Ambassador Andrew Young, and a young Jesse Jackson to speak in his behalf. And he's going to stay at the Lorraine Motel, room 306, and do some work on the Poor People's Campaign. Once they arrive at the Mason Temple, people are clapping. It's 2,000 people in this auditorium, and there's lightning and thunder all going on outside. Ralph Abernathy understood very well that this was not their crowd. He even said to Andy Young, he said, "They think Martin's coming in behind us." So Dr. King gets a phone call from Ralph Abernathy outside at the Mason Temple. He says, "Doc, this is an electric crowd here. I really think it will benefit us in the movement if you come and speak to them." Dr. King, always lacking that aura and speak, he rushes over. Again, this man is suffering from laryngitis. He's not feeling well. He's got a fever. And he comes over, and Ralph Abernathy gives him an unusually different introduction that afternoon, that night. And when Dr. King takes to the stage, he usually has footnotes, but he doesn't have anything this time. And he's talking about his journey through the civil rights movement and how happy and blessed that he was to be with them that night in the city of Memphis. He talked about in 1958, how he was stabbed in Harlem, New York City by a deranged woman. He talks about the sit-in movement of 1960, the Freedom Riders of 1961, the eventual and prolific victory in Birmingham. He talks about the tragedies, where four little girls were killed in a Sunday school in September, where civil rights workers were killed in Mississippi and disappeared. He talks about sanitation workers here in that city. But then it becomes very eerie that night. So I want you all meditate for a second and think, if you were in that church that night and you hear the thunder roaring, and you're looking at Dr. King, and then he says something that everyone in that audience was very unprepared to hear. He said, "Well, I don't know what'll happen now. We have some difficult days ahead, but that really doesn't matter to me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. I'm not concerned about that now because I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go to the mountain, and I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So tonight I'm not worried. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." It's 10:30, April the 3rd, 1968. He gets back and he rests. He wakes up that morning, and to everyone's surprise, Dr. King, the funk that he had been in was gone. He was in a joyous and jubilant mood. He could not wait until they had the injunction set upon them to not be able to march in the streets of Memphis, to come back and be in their support and in their favor. Once they arrive back, and Andy Young comes back and delivers this news, they're having pillow fights. Dr. King, there's three things that he liked. He loved his family, he loved Star Trek, and he loved soul food. He loved catfish, sweet potatoes, collard greens, hot water cornbread. Someone said that was going to be going, he says, "I'm there." There was nothing different about this night. A local Memphis minister was going to have a soul food dinner prepared for Dr. King and his aides. So at the Lorraine Motel on that day, Dr. King goes back into room 306. He dresses, And he steps outside on the balcony of the veranda. He's speaking to people in the parking lot. One of the persons that he talks to is a young Jesse Jackson at this time. And he says, "Jesse, where is your tie? You know you need to have a tie to go to dinner." Jesse looks up and says, "Doc, a prerequisite for dinner is an appetite, and that's what I do have." And they laugh. He's then approached by a musician from Chicago named Ben Branch. And Ben Branch is there to play at the rally the following day. And Doc says, "Ben, I want you to play Precious Lord, Take My Hand. And I want you to play it real pretty." Ben Branch says, "I will do that, Doc." His chauffeur, Solomon Jones, who's going to caravan him over to Memphis Minister's home, says, "Doc, it's getting kind of cold outside. You should go and grab a jacket." Dr. King responds with, "Do you really think I'll need my coat?" And he's taken from us. And he's pronounced dead an hour and 4 minutes later. Uprisings, rebellions, riots, all occur in the entire United States of America. Memphis, Watts, Harlem, Detroit, Chicago, the greater Kansas City area has uprisings indirectly involved in the assassination. And while most of the world was so concerned with who killed him versus looking at what killed him, and that's still something that's very relevant today, 50 years later, a man who was 39 years old, a son, a brother, a husband, the father of Yolanda, Martin III, Dexter, and Bernice, had the heart of a 70-year-old man filling his autopsy. When Dr. King died on that balcony of the Lorraine Motel, he was the most hated man in America. But today, he's one of the most glorified and celebrated. 900 streets are named after Martin Luther King Jr. Next Monday, we'll observe the 32nd federal holiday signed by Ronald Reagan in 1986. Arrested 29 times in 12 years. 50 cross burnings in his yard. His home bombed twice. So where are we today? It's still there. Until we can truly embrace the sacrifices, the courage, the leadership that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. allowed for us to be in this auditorium today, we as people have to be accountable for the hate, for the fear that's still dividing us today as a society. So when we leave from this place, yes, we are upset that he's no longer here, but his spirit very well lives in all of us. What can you do in your society to provide that service that Dr. King and so many others alike him can do?
You have been listening to Ryan Jones summarizing the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr.